If you are new, as we said, we are starting this new series that I'm just so excited about. We're going to be doing something that we've never done before in our time, at least when I've been here. I've done a kind of character study on the life of Jesus, but I've never done a character study on anybody else. And so I'm excited to do that with you. Of our 10 plus years together here doing this, I've never done. I don't know why I haven't done one before, but we're going to do one today. So we're going to kick one off today. So I'm very excited about that. We're going to be looking at the life of a guy named Moses. And he is maybe perhaps one of the most influential, just impactful leaders that we have in our history. He wrote maybe more of the scriptures than anybody else. He's credited with writing the first five books of the Bible. His leadership skills have been studied and read about and talked about. People are still studying his failures and successes as a leader. Jesus quoted, I think, Moses more than anybody else when Jesus taught. He's lived. I mean, we have more of his story, I think, than most people in Scripture. We have his from birth to death, which is amazing. So all that to say, I'm excited to study Moses because Moses, as Ron Burgundy would say, is kind of a big deal if you're not new to the Bible world. He's kind of a big deal. So we're gonna look at Moses' life, but I'm also excited because looking at Moses' life gives us an opportunity, a chance to really get back into the Old Testament and get familiar with the Old Testament. I know a lot of people kind of, like to look at the Bible and see two big parts. You have the Old Testament and you have the New Testament, and they kind of see this kind of big divide, but really the Old and New Testament is really just one giant story, which I'm very excited about to share with you and kind of talk with you about. So it's really helpful to have the back end of the story. I know a lot of us, look at the New Testament and think, okay, well, we're New Testament church and things of that nature. But it's kind of like if you walk into a movie or you look at, I love the Lord of the Rings. I talk about it almost every week. Lord of the Rings trilogy, right? If you watch the third movie, that's one thing, and you can walk away just going, okay, I get it, that's great, the third movie. But if you miss the first two movies, you miss so much of the context, you miss so much. And so really, the Bible is one giant story, and if you don't have a good understanding of the Old Testament, then you're really not going to really appreciate the New. You can understand it. I'm sure people who lived in the first century world, Gentiles, non-Jewish people, didn't have the Old Testament scriptures. They could be Jesus followers, but to have the Old Testament, I'm telling you, helps create just a whole level of understanding and context that you can't get without it. So that's important. So I'm really excited to go through the Old Testament. And just to let you know, if you're new to the Bible, the Old Testament isn't just a bunch of, random stories, right? I mean, this is the difference between New Testament and Old Testament. The New Testament gives us a lot of instruction. It's a lot of, here's what you do, here's what you don't do. What the Old Testament does, the Old Testament gives us stories. That's what the Old Testament does. That's really helpful for us. Old Testament stories really, again, add another layer to everything. It'd be a little bit like if I told you, New Testament way of saying, hey, don't, or be careful when you eat a little bit of a hard piece of candy, round candy, marble candy, you could choke on it. That's kind of like how New Testament would say, don't do this, do that kind of thing. Or I could tell you, when I was a little kid, I remember sitting at Worcester Grace in a pew, I was, chewing on a little hard piece of candy, a little bit marble kind of shaped size, and it got stuck down the wrong pipe. And my mom looked over and saw that I was struggling for breath. And what did she do? She went over and said, dear, I think Dave's choking, And I could tell you that story, how I interrupt the whole service kind of thing real quick. But I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to tell you the story. But you see the point. Stories are impactful. Stories are just powerful things. And so they add a little bit of extra layer of things and dimension. So the Old Testament will give us stories. And that's what we're going to look at. But it's not, again, just not random stories. It's a story of really, if you are new to the Bible, it's really about the story of one family. A family that comes from one man, a man who has, incredible impact on our faith and probably all the three major religions' faith, all point back to this guy. But it starts with a man named Abraham. Abraham was an older man by the time God just revealed himself to him. And he gave Abraham four big promises that you need to know, that to kind of give, again, context to this whole story. Four promises he revealed. He says this, that I will make you into a great nation. Now, that was a huge promise because at that point, Abraham had no children. But he says, eventually, I will make you into a great nation. He says, two, I will make your name great. And that has come true, hasn't it? We all have heard of, chances are, even if you didn't go, you know, to church growing up, you probably heard of Father Abraham, right? Who had many, now I won't get into it. But I will make your name great. And that's what happened, right? Number three, I will bless those who bless you. He made a promise to Abraham. He says, all those people who are kind to you, I will bless you and bless them who bless you. And also he said, I will curse those who curse you. But that was the big one. And then finally he said this, that he says, all people on earth will be blessed through you. Now, that is a huge promise that really impacts you and I, because looking back, we know where that blessing, what that blessing was referring to. He's referring to Jesus, that through Abraham's family line, Jesus would eventually come and Jesus would eventually rescue us out of sin and death. But those are the promises that Abraham, and those were laughable, again, because he was old, he had no children. In fact, Sarah, his wife, laughed at that. But eventually, God would keep his promise. And Abraham had Isaac. And Isaac eventually had Jacob. And Jacob would have 12 sons. I have four. I can't even imagine 12 sons. But Jacob has 12 sons, the most famous of those sons being Joseph. And if you know the story of Joseph, another great character study that we need to look at sometime, but Joseph was the favorite, but Joseph was hated by his brothers. And so his brothers sold Joseph down to slavery, and ends up down into Egypt. But he eventually becomes second in command of all Egypt. And he rescues the Egyptians out of a famine. And so in his great power, you know, the family comes down because there's no food. And the family, the brothers who sold him to slavery, come down to Egypt. And they have this just incredible moment. And Joseph, who has all the power now, who could just end their brother's life in a heartbeat, looks to his brothers and says these really incredible, famous words at the end of Genesis. He says, you intended to harm me, but God intended it for good, to accomplish what is now being done, the saving of many lives. What a huge statement. He had such incredible perspective, a God kind of perspective, saying, listen, I know you intended to harm me. I know you just wanted to get rid of me. But listen, God had a bigger plan in mind, and it involved the saving of many lives. And so Joseph not only saves the Egyptians out of a drought, he rescues his family. And we're told that Joseph and his family all move to Egypt. They all are allowed a really great land just to thrive in Egypt. And they're welcome guests, and they're kind of welcome immigrants. And they settle down in the area of Goshen. And they begin to multiply, and they begin to grow. In fact, where we pick up the story is in Exodus, starting in verse 6 of chapter 1. Here's what we're told. It says, now Joseph and all his brothers and all the generation, they died. So now we're told like a whole generation has come and gone now since that time of Joseph. But here's what happens. But the Israelites were exceedingly fruitful, and they multiplied greatly. They increased in numbers and became so numerous that the land was filled with them. So they really just kind of took to heart this idea of, hey, be fruitful and multiply. And so they did. And so the Egyptian culture and land and all that, they really just became a kind of an incubator for the Israelites just to multiply and to grow. And so they thrived, and God blessed them, right? And they were a people of blessing, and they could feel that God's hand was on them. They're just really thriving down here in Egypt. And then we're told something happens. There's a change in leadership. And just like as in today, change of leadership means change of laws and culture and all those kinds of things. It says, then a new king, to whom Joseph meant nothing. And I like that new translation. Old translations may have that a new king who did not know Joseph. I'm sure every king and every, you know, person knew the story of Joseph. And we still talk about it today. I think I like this translation better because it says he didn't really care. Like he knew about Joseph, but Joseph didn't mean anything to him. And so he came into power in Egypt. And then he looked around, he noticed all these Israelites and all these people who, in a sense, were kind of foreigners, and now they're thriving and they're growing. He says, look, he said to his people, the Israelites have become far too numerous for us. Come, we must deal shrewdly with them, or they will become even more numerous, and if war breaks out, they'll join our enemies, fight against us, and then leave the country. And so what we're told is they enslave the Israelites. These people who were just, you know, welcome guests, these immigrants, now they see them as a threat. Now they just enslave them. Now they're in charge of building like cities for Pharaoh. And it just gets worse and worse and worse for them. But the more it gets worse, we're told, the more they're oppressed, the more they end up being, you know, multiplying themselves. The more they grow. In fact, here's a great summary statement in verse 14 that I think just encapsulates life of an Israelite back in that period. It says, they made their lives bitter with harsh labor in brick and mortar and with all kinds of work in the fields. In all their harsh labor, the Egyptians worked them ruthlessly. Now, the English translation here does not serve this sentence or this statement, you know, justice. I mean, this is a interesting summary statement. This is actually, the Old Testament is actually written in Hebrew. And here, the English translators take the same Hebrew word and basically use different synonyms to kind of spice up the translation a little bit so it's not as boring. But really, in this verse, the same word, advath, which means to serve under a master, to serve in kind of harsh conditions, is used over and over and over again. So I'm going to give you kind of the Hebrew version, the more literal translation of this, just to kind of get the point across of what life was like for an Israelite. Here's what it really says. It says, they made their lives bitter with serving and brick and mortar, and with all kinds of serving in the fields. In all their serving, the Egyptians made them serve. That's how it literally reads. And so you can understand how the English translators thought, this is kind of boring, we need to make it a little bit, a little spice it up, and it's just too repetitive. But this is the point. Like, you served as an Israelite, and when you were done serving, guess what you did? You served. And when you were serving, you served, and you served, and you served, and you served. And that's just what life was like. You just served all day long, every day. There was no break, there was no rest, there was no Sabbath, there was nothing. You just served. And so life just went on for the Israelites. It was a struggle. But we're told, right, as they continue to serve, as they continue to be oppressed, they continue to grow and multiply. And so the king says, you know, we got to do something about this. They keep growing. And so here's what happens. The king of Egypt said to the Hebrew midwives, whose names were Shiphrah and Puah. So just pause there for a second. This is so fascinating to me. Do you know that scholars for centuries have just been, you know, beating their heads against the wall trying to figure out who this king of Egypt really was? Because he has no name in this story. We don't really know for sure who this Egyptian pharaoh really was. But do you know who they name? Two midwives. That's interesting to me. You see, midwives, you know, were women who couldn't or, you know, didn't have children of their own. That's a midwife. And so in that culture, you had women who were already on the lowest rung of the cultural pole, basically. But underneath that, you had midwives, basically, because, you know, women were seen as basically just good for having children. And if you didn't have children, then you were even lower than that. And so here are two midwives, Shiphrah and Puah. And they're being recognized and named. I think that's fascinating. We're going to get back to them later on. But he calls them in. And here's what happens. He says, when you are helping the Hebrew women during childbirth on delivery stool, if you see that the baby is a boy, kill him. But if it is a girl, let her live. Now, infanticide was not uncommon in that culture. But it was kind of a reversed infanticide than this. Most of the time, you would kill a girl, not a boy. And it was really a very common idea, common thing throughout many, many cultures. In fact, we actually have a manuscript, which was later on from an Egyptian. This is really first century BC, but it was an Egyptian businessman who was on a business trip to Rome, writing a letter back to his wife in Alexandria. And so he writes this letter to her, and here's what he writes. He says, I beg and entreat you, take care of the little one, and as soon as we receive our pay, I will send it up to you. If by chance you bear a child, if it is a boy, let it be. But if it's a girl, expose it. In other words, hey, if you end up having a boy, great, let's keep it. If it's a girl, expose it. Let's get rid of it. Exposure was a way of you set it out to let, basically, you expose it to nature, to the elements, to wild animals, to people who would come and grab your baby if they wanted a baby. I mean, exposure was just a way of getting rid of your child. And so this was a very common practice, but it was really reversed normally. It was get rid of the girl and keep the boy. And it really didn't change until, basically, Rome adopted Christianity as their, you know, national religion, and things began to change that way. But up to that point, many, many cultures, this is what they practiced, infanticide. Get rid of the the child that you don't want. If it's a hindrance, if it's annoyance, if it's not what you wanted, just get rid of it. And so that's what he tells the midwives to do. Just, if you see, if it's a boy, then kill it. We don't want the boys. We don't care about the girls. Girls, we can, you know, intermingle, and Egyptians and, you know, Israelites can, you know. But if it's a boy, then that's just building an army for them. We don't want boys. So get rid of them. And so the midwives, you know, are kind of stuck, you know, like, what do we do? What do we do? Well, they don't listen to Pharaoh. They refuse to listen to Pharaoh. They're like, we can't do this. We can't kill all these boys. And so they come up with this kind of excuse, and they basically come back to Pharaoh and say, I don't know if you noticed, but these Hebrew women, they're vigorous. I mean, they just have these babies before we can get there, and we just can't do it. And so they continue to grow. They continue to multiply. And so then Pharaoh's left with his kind of final solution to all of this. He says, then Pharaoh gave this order to all his people. Every Hebrew boy that is born, you must throw into the Nile, but let every girl live. And so at this point in our story, man, it goes from bad to worse to now even, I mean, this is just not looking good for the Israelites. I mean, this is just the life. It's just hard, and it gets harder and harder and harder. And what's interesting is a whole lifetime has come by, right? A whole generation, right? By the end of Genesis 50, I mean, everything's working out really well. But by the end of Exodus chapter 1, there is really no mention of God, is there, in this story. If you just go home and read just the chapter, there's no mention of God. And I think the author, who, again, we think is Moses, who wrote, you know, the first five books, I think he's trying to get a point across here. I think he's trying to relate to you maybe exactly what they were feeling, exactly what we feel when times get bad, when times get hard, when times go not the way that we plan. We feel like, God, where are you, right? The question that they were wrestling with was, where is God in all this? I thought we were the people of blessing. I thought God had our backs. I thought God was going to, you know, rescue us and do something with us. And all it just seems like it's getting worse and worse and worse. God, where are you? When are you going to keep your promises? When is enough going to be enough? And I know some of you are here struggling right now. You're going through things, and you're just wondering, when is God going to do something? I thought God cared. I thought God loved me. I thought God had my corner. Now, I don't know, because God's not here. I feel absent. I feel distant. And then God responds. This is the amazing thing. God responds to all of their suffering, to all of this hardship, with a birth narrative. God responds with giving a baby, basically, to them. Here's how the story continues in chapter 2. It says, now a man of the tribe of Levi married a Levite woman. Now they're referring to Moses' parents, but we're not told this yet. But we're not told their names here, Moses' parents. So any overachievers in the room, anybody know the parents of Moses? It's Amram and Jochebed. So if you have Bible trivia this later today for lunch or whatever, you can quiz. Amram and Jochebed. We're told in chapter 6, that's their names, but we're not told their names here. It's interesting. But Amram and Jochebed are this Levite couple, and they have already two kids. They have who? Anybody? You guys can shout out answers today. It's all right. Miriam and Aaron, right? These are the two kids they already have. Miriam, we're not really told her age. We can maybe guess around 7 to 10 years old. Aaron, we're told later on that he's 3 years older than Moses. So here they already have a boy and a girl. They already set. I mean, they got kids. They have their boy. They have a boy that has already, you know, flew underneath the cutoff line. So they're safe. They have their kids. And then they hear about this edict that Pharaoh sends out to have every boy thrown in the Nile. And I'm sure their first thought was, oh man, too bad for, you know, the Millers, too bad for the Johnsons, too bad for, you know, whoever's pregnant at this time that we know. Oh man, I don't know what they would do. I don't know what I would do in that situation. I'm sure they were just thinking, oh, that's so sad for so-and-so and so-and-so and so-and-so, just like what we would do. And so they have two kids, boy and a girl. Things are going fine. And then suddenly we're told, she became pregnant. Uh-oh. I mean, you talk about bad timing with all of this. You talk about just a kind of an unplanned, what do we do now? We were pregnant. Let's hope. Let's pray. It's not a boy. I mean, I don't think, you know, in that culture they really prayed for girls that much just because the way they saw girls back in that day. But I'm sure they were thinking, God, you know, if anything, just let it be a girl. Because if it was a boy, I don't know what I'm going to do. I don't know what we're going to do. This is such bad timing. This is not what we, you know, just what do we do? What do we do? What do we do? And then 9 months later, after all that, you know, all the praying, all the worrying, because, you know, what are we going to do if we have a boy? And the baby comes. And surprise, it's a boy. Now what do we do? What would you do? I mean, what do we do now? It's a boy. We were, you know, God, what are you doing? You know, what do we do? And then we're told this, that when she saw that he was a fine child, she hid him for 3 months. Now, this is interesting for two reasons. One is when she saw that he was a fine child. Some of your translations may have a beautiful child. And some people think and suggest that because he was so good looking that she decided to keep him. And I don't think that's the case. Because the word that is used for here is for the word fine or for beautiful is actually the same word that is found in Genesis 1 that is used over and over and over again to describe how God felt about his creation. That every time he made something, he saw that it was what? Good. This is the same word. It's the same Hebrew word. Ki tov, meaning good. And my guess, I'm just speculating, I'm just kind of reading into it a little bit, but I'm thinking this is what's going on. That she perhaps, you know, for 9 months, she was kind of dreading this, you know, delivery. She was dreading what was going to happen if it was a boy. She's thinking, this is such a bad timing. This is so bad. This is so bad. This is so bad. And then finally, the baby comes, and she gets a chance for the first time to see it. And she sees it, and she saw it was good. Just like God's creation, it was good. It was ketov. How can I ever think about getting rid of this? I mean, this is so good. In fact, you know, we support places like Miami Valley Women's Center, who have women who are having unexpected pregnancies or unplanned pregnancies or just a baby, just bad timing. They come in, and they're given free ultrasounds just so they can see the baby for the first time. And what we're told is the stats greatly increase that women are going to keep their baby if they have a chance just to see the baby before the delivery. And I think this is Moses' mom saying, this is good. This is a good creation. I can't get rid of this. I can't throw this, you know, the baby in the Nile. This is good. But it says that she hid him for 3 months. Now, to me, that's a miracle in itself, because if you've had newborn babies, that's crazy, right? How do you hide a newborn for that long? I mean, it is so loud at the wrong times throughout the night. How do you do that? And so my guess is they all sat down and watched A Quiet Place first, just to kind of prep all the, I'm just joking, that's a movie, never mind. But how do you do that, right? What do you do? But they did it for 3 months. They hid it. But they finally got to the point where we can't hide this baby any longer. What do we do? Now remember, what was the law? The law was what? To take a son and throw him into the Nile, right? So Jochebed, I think she's just a brilliant woman. She comes up with her own creative way of doing this. She practices what Christians and what people of faith have practiced for many, many, you know, centuries and decades. Creative civil disobedience. Creative civil disobedience. Think about this. All right? What was the law was what? Throw the baby in the Nile. So guess what I'm going to do? I'm going to throw my baby into the Nile, but just so happens that there's going to be a basket to catch him, right? I'm going to create this little kind of arc and tar and pitch, and oops, you know, I threw the baby in the Nile, but it just happened to fall in a basket. Oh, it just happened to be among the reeds, and it just happened to be where Pharaoh's daughter comes to bathe, you know, kind of thing. And I think this is great. I think this is a great reminder to us Christians. You know, we are called to always submit to the laws of the land as long as it continues to be under God's law and character and nature, right? It looks like we're always being, you know, submissive to the government, but really we're always obeying God. And God says, you know, obey the laws. But until the laws then pull you out of that, then we're called to still continue to obey God. And so Christians and people of faith for a long, long time had to practice this kind of creative civil disobedience when the laws of the land and laws of God collide. So this is just a great reminder. Sometimes we've got to do that. And so she does that, and it just happens to be, you know, on a basket down by the river. And, you know, so That's what happens. And so Pharaoh's daughter is down there bathing, just like she normally does. And her attendants see this baby in a basket and bring the baby over. And here's what happened. She opened it and saw the baby, and he was crying, and she felt sorry for him. And I can understand this because, you know, having four boys and our first 6 months of each boy's, you know, the first 6 months was just rough. You kind of, anybody else get callous to their own babies crying after a while? Just me? I don't know. I just, you know, just. But for other kids, when they're crying, I'm like, oh, you got to do something right away. If my kid's like, oh, they're fine. But when it's somebody else's baby, it's like, oh, you know, oh, you just have so much compassion and mercy. And so here's this Pharaoh's daughter, and she sees this baby. Now, think about Pharaoh's daughter. Let me just tell you this, that Pharaoh probably had probably a larger household than just a daughter. I mean, we're told that Pharaoh's had many wives, many concubines. So to be a part of Pharaoh's household was a big deal, right? But it was no small number. So chances are she's probably one of many. But here's Pharaoh's daughter. She sees this baby, and she recognizes it's probably because it was circumcised. This is a Hebrew baby. In fact, she says, this is one of those Hebrew babies, she said. And she finds it, she recognizes it, and then suddenly this little girl just happens to be standing right there saying, hey, I know somebody who could help watch that child. I know somebody who could nurse that child if you just happen to need someone to do that. Now, I think at this point in the story, and again, I'm maybe reading into this, but I think Pharaoh's daughter knows what's up, right? I think she's probably a smarter, you know, she's well-educated. I think she realizes this is not an unsolvable mystery whose baby this really is, that there's a connection here because this woman, you know, this little girl just happened to be right here. And so this girl says, I can find you, which happens to be Miriam. I can find you someone to watch. And so she runs and gets Jochebed. And, you know, I don't think too long after, Jochebed's right there. And this whole thing is kind of like, oh, yeah, of course, you're the mom. You've kind of set this out for me. I think she's probably putting this together. But Pharaoh's daughter plays along because, you know, this is her chance to be a mom, but she doesn't have to, you know, do the whole mom thing for the first few years. She doesn't have to worry about the sleepless nights. She doesn't have to worry about the body, you know, kind of getting rearranged and changed around. She can be Pharaoh's daughter and have this baby when she's ready for him. So she agrees, and she pays Jochebed. Talk about this deal. She pays Jochebed to take care of her own child. Moms, I mean, can you think of a better deal than that? That's amazing. And so for the first few years, and we don't know how long, some people suggest 3 to 5, other people have suggested 5 to 8. We don't know how long, but for a few of the most, you know, fundamental growing up kind of years for a child, he got to live with his family. It's amazing. And then it says this, when the child grew older, she took him to Pharaoh's daughter, and he became her son. I imagine that was a heartbreaking, kind of bittersweet moment. Like, here's my child, I've raised him, and now I'm giving him to you. I mean, come on, how hard would that be? But this was Pharaoh's household. This meant he didn't have to be a slave. This meant he had the best education, the best training, the best, you know, everything at his, whatever, his whim. He could have it. Wow. So you can just imagine just the mix of emotions. And then we're finally told the name of this child. And Pharaoh's daughter named him Moses, saying, I drew him out of the water. I've always wondered what his name was prior to that, for the first 3 years or 5 years. Was it Bob? Was it Steve? You know, was it as cool as Moses? I don't know. Probably not, but it was now Moses. A new name he's been given, a new family, a new household. But just think about how perfect all this was. Just think about how perfect. I mean, the first few formative years of his life, he was able to get his Hebrew identity, his Jewish identity. He was able to understand and know who his real, you know, biological mom and dad and siblings all were. He had the opportunity to identify with the Hebrew people, and that would be so important later because he could not be the nation's leader if he did not have that Jewish identity to fall back on. But at the same time, he was given, again, everything, you know, as far as education, training, equipping. I mean, he was given everything. And so in order to become a leader of, you know, tens of thousands of people, at least hundreds of thousands of people, he would have to have the skill, the training, the experience that only Egyptian, you know, Pharaoh's household could provide. It was absolutely perfect from that perspective. Wow. Now, why is that all important this morning? Why is that, you know, because we're going to just pause here. Why is that, you know, what's the point? Or what's all this leading to? See, I think, again, I'm just reading in text. I don't think anyone imagined their actions would have led to Moses being the leader of the people of God, leading them out of Egypt. I don't think any of them. I don't think the midwives knew that if we just obeyed God rather than Pharaoh, this would result in a leader coming out of, you know, and being able to rescue us. I don't think Jochebed and Miriam. I think they maybe had a plan to maybe try to see, you know, if Pharaoh's daughter was interested. I don't know. But again, they had no idea what Pharaoh's daughter, you know, response was going to be. She could have easily said, "Ew, yuck, a baby, a Hebrew baby. Let's get rid of it right away. Dad told us to kill all of them. Let's yuck." I mean, they had no idea. I'm sure they could not even have dreamed, imagined such a scenario as the one actually came about. I'm sure Pharaoh had no idea. I mean, nobody had this all planned out. Nobody had an idea of all this. It's just too perfect. And see, that's the thing. That's one of the things that I think we need to just highlight this morning, is that just because you didn't plan it doesn't mean it was unplanned, right? Just because you didn't dream of it, didn't come up with it, doesn't mean it was unplanned. And I think Moses, is when he's writing this, is just referencing, just going back to just how sovereign God really is. That he has all of this kind of working out in the background, that all of this could not have just come together by coincidence. Moses just wasn't just that lucky baby out of all of those, you know, hundreds of, you know, thousands of other. No, God had a plan. In fact, Moses could look back. I think Moses could have looked back and had, you know, sat down with Pharaoh, who made this incredible, just ugly, despicable edict. And I think he could have said the same thing that Joseph said to his brothers. "Pharaoh, you intended to harm me, but I'm telling you, God intended it for good, to accomplish what is now being done, the saving of many lives." That's God's sovereignty. And we see this, and we're going to see this over and over again through the theme of the Old Testament and Exodus, that God is sovereign. God is so big that he allows us to have a choice, that we can choose good or bad. But even if it's evil, even if it's harmful, even if it's ugly, God says, "I can use that for good." So just because you didn't have a plan, just because you can't see the good, doesn't mean there isn't going to be any good to come out of it. Just because you didn't have a plan doesn't mean it was unplanned. God is that sovereign and that big. And I think it's easy to lose sight of, again, because it's easy to say, "God, where are you in all this? Where are you? I don't see your hand. I don't see you moving. I just see it getting from bad to worse to even worser. God, what are you doing?" God's going, "God, you just got to trust me. Just because you didn't plan for this doesn't mean it was unplanned." I think all of these events, including Pharaoh's edict, all points to God's rescue plan. This is all just too perfect, right? All too perfect. So here's the other thing that I want to just talk about real quickly. When you look at the story, and Mike, you want to go to the next slide. If you look at the story, keep going. God uses little people to do big things. God uses little people to do big things. This is going to be our theme of our sermon series. In fact, this is the theme throughout the Old Testament. You start all the way back in Genesis, and what do you find? God using, in a sense, the wrong people, the people who have been exploited, the outsiders, the downcast, the oppressed. God uses kind of all, in a sense, the wrong people to accomplish his plans. God uses the second born, not the firstborn, because the firstborn was always supposed to be the one of blessing, the one that, you know, you're supposed to pass everything on. God uses the second. He uses Abel, not Cain. He uses, you know, Jacob, not Esau. I mean, he uses the wrong people, in a sense, over and over. He uses the barren woman, the unloved woman, you know. He uses Sarah, not Hagar. He uses Leah, not Rachel. He uses all these people over and over and again that you would not suspect, that you would go, "Those are the wrong people, God. Those aren't the right people. I mean, what are you doing?" God's going, "I love to use the wrong people to accomplish my big plans." I mean, if you think about the story, again, the midwives. I mean, again, the lowest of the low. And here they are, and they're just going, "You know what, God, we're gonna follow you instead of Pharaoh's edict." We see, again, Jochebed and Miriam saying, "God, we're going to risk our lives we're going to risk our lives. You see the outsiders, you see what I'm saying? You see the people that you just normally wouldn't suspect becoming the heroes of the story. Even Pharaoh's daughter, who is really a religious outsider, who is ethnically an outsider, God uses her mercy and her compassion. She's not even a believer. She doesn't even know this God, but God uses her to accomplish his plans. In fact, that's what you see throughout, don't you? You see all the heroes of chapter 1 and 2 are who? Are all females. That's interesting to me. In a culture, in a setting, in a time where females were seen as second-class citizens, here's God going, no, 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 no. Not in my economy. And he uses these women, these moms or mom-like figures, to do incredible, incredible things. God uses little people every single day to accomplish his big plans. Now, this is something that Moses is not, just doesn't understand. He's not getting it, as we're going to find out, you know, throughout the story, that this is how God works. I mean, Moses, who looks perfect on paper, I mean, his resume is spotless for who would be the best leader for Israel. But when God comes to Moses, we're going to find out, Moses is so reluctant. It's not me, it's not me, it's not me, it's not me. You don't understand, God, I can't talk right. I just fumble and stumble and da-da-da. I can't do it, I can't do it, I can't do it. God, I'm not the guy, I'm not the guy. And God goes, no, no, no. You're perfect. You're the perfect candidate. No, you don't understand. I have a past. I have a history. And that's what all of us think. God, I can't do it. I can't do it. I can't do it. God says, if you think you can't do it, maybe that makes you the perfect candidate for it. Because that's the people I love, I love, I love to use. But we hear that all the time when we talk to people. Hey, you want to teach something? You want to lead something? That's not me. That's not me. I don't know enough. I'm not that kind of person. I'm not that good a speaker. And we all kind of take a step back. And if that's you, I just want you to know throughout the series, that was Moses. Moses is going to go, nope, nope, I want to hide out in the shadows. God's going, no, you don't understand. I love taking the wrong type of people, the little people, the people that you wouldn't suspect, the people who have, you know, seemingly nothing to offer, and I love to use them in such mighty and big ways. So if you're thinking, I'm a nobody this morning, great. God can use you in big, big ways. Disciple making. We talk about disciple making here a lot. God can use you in disciple making, no matter who you are. So don't think, because of your past, because of your history, because of your lack of whatever, you can't be used. Now, I want to wrap up just by talking to moms for a moment. And here's just a principle that I just see in the text that I just wanted to highlight to you, just to encourage you this morning. Never underestimate how God can use your faith. Just never underestimate that. Because here's the deal. You don't know what hangs in the balance. These midwives had no idea what hung in the balance of their faithfulness to God, their acts of obedience. They had no idea what that would result in. Yet they continued to remain faithful because that was the point. Say, God, we trust you with what's to come, but we're just trying to be faithful here. Jochebed, Miriam, had no idea of what their faithfulness would mean by protecting this child. But they just stayed faithful. And I know as moms, you know, as a dad, it's hard. It's hard to be doing the right things constantly, right? It wears on us. It's challenging. We sacrifice so much for our kids. Yesterday was a whole day. I mean, My son asked my wife, hey, can I put this plate in the oven? My wife thought he meant the microwave oven, not the real oven. So my son puts a plastic plate in the oven at 350 degrees. I come inside from mowing, and I say, Sam, what are you doing? He's like, I'm cooking some pizza. And I look in the oven, and there's this plate just dripping down out, you know? And it's like, what do you do with that? You know, it's just like, you're going nuts. And as we're cleaning up that mess, we open the doors because it's such a, you know, it's just plastic smell everywhere. The doors open, the front door. My little three-year-old grabs one of our good plates because I was redoing a cabinet. He grabs one of the really good plates. And he walks out of the door and just chucks it onto the sidewalk. And I'm going, I am failing as a parent, you know. And this was before the water fight upstairs that I had to clean up while I was mowing. It was just a nightmare yesterday, right? And moms, you guys have to deal with it. I mean, you guys know. And I just want to encourage you, just keep being faithful. to keep doing the right things. Keep leading in the right way. Keep pointing them to Jesus. Keep talking with them about Jesus. Keep praying with them and for them. Just keep doing that, because you never know what hangs in the balance. And even if you're not a mom, if you're mom-like, if you're mom-ish, if you work with our kids, and the Grace kids, or Juana, man, you just don't know what hangs in the balance. Maybe just that one conversation you know you need to have with a kid, you know, and you just feel like God is prodding you. Have it. You know, be sensitive, be listening, because you never know what hangs in the balance. All of these women did not. And yet, look what happened. God rescues his people. And I think about the story, I can't help but think of the ultimate mother in the whole story. You know, the big story is Mary, right? I mean, she's the ultimate mom of Jesus, right? And here she is. She's been given this, hey, I'm going to rescue the people. How are you going to do that? Through a birth narrative. Sound familiar, Mary? And I can't help but think Mary drew back onto this story to go, oh, well, you've done that before. What am I supposed to do? I'm just supposed to stay faithful. I'm your servant, Lord. Whatever you have, may it happen. I just can't help but think that this was somehow, maybe she had that in mind. Never underestimate what God can use, how God can use your faithfulness. Because we serve a big God, a big God. Even if we think of just little old me, we serve a big, big God. And he can do big things through any of us.